Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
He kōna I purangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
This podcast includes discussion of self-harm, suicide and sexual assault. Please listen with care. If you or someone you know needs support, you can contact the Need to Talk helpline anytime, day or night, by texting or calling 1737. A wider list of mental health support services can be found on our show page, www.rnz.co.nz/Nellie's Baby.
What was it like up there? Did she tell you how she felt about living there?
She never really said, did she?
But there were signs of a lot of healed fractures. I'm like, from what? From memory. I mean, maybe I've made it worse in my head, which no, I could have done.
And I said to the doctor, how did she get that? Well, how come she got a skin graft?
Do you ever remember her having broken arms or legs? Because I thought I remembered reading it was a fractured skull.
After we leave our meeting with Mavis and Tracy, their questions and Sarah's questions about how Nellie died stick with me for days. They go round and round inside my head, alongside questions of my own. Was Nellie's death malicious, or was it neglect? I'm feeling so impatient to get my hands on the coronial file we know is coming, but I'm also feeling a little stressed. During our interview with Mavis, I made sure to check what she was hoping for and if there was anything she was worried about in terms of our investigation. I thought Mavis might say something like she was worried about us digging up the past or that she didn't want certain aspects of Nellie's life to go in the podcast. But she wasn't worried.
So what would you like to know, Mavis, if you could ask them questions now? What is it that you would like to know?
I would like to know what happened to her, you know, but how did she really pass? But how do we know we're going to get the truth? There's always cover-ups. These patients, you know, they're put in these places. They've got rights and they should be looked after.
It's good that we've got someone like you, Sarah.
Well, it's bothered me for all this time, but I'm sorry it's taken so long.
It's lovely, Sarah.
Well, it's
your mum would be watching you up there.
She'd be watching you up there and she'd be amazed.
Talking to Mavis has left me feeling more responsible than ever for getting answers. I feel like Sarah and I have made her a promise, and now we have to keep it. I'm Kirsty Johnston, and this is Nellie's Baby. Episode 7. What happened to Nellie? It's been 3 weeks since that trip to see Mavis, and we are still waiting for Nellie's full file from the coroner's office. The hope was that we would get the documents while Sarah was in New Zealand and be able to read them together. Then we could visit some of her clinicians who had treated Nellie or the staff who'd care for her. So we waited that week, and then another week. But the file didn't arrive, and by late January, it was time for Sarah to go back to the UK. And then, of course, as soon as she got home, guess what turned up? I was actually out of town on another job when I woke up one morning to find Sarah had forwarded me a dozen emails from the coroner. The files were so big that they had to be sent in chunks. They were so big that, in the remote area where I was working, on the East Coast, I couldn't even open them on my phone. When I got home a few days later, I was finally able to have a look. The first email says, "Dear Sarah, thank you for your request regarding your late biological mother, Nellie.
Copies of the requested documents are released to you under the Official Information Act and the Coroner's Act. The released documents contain material that you may find distressing, and I would recommend that you open them in the presence of and with the support of a family member or friend."
The email said the files were attached in 11 bundles. Each bundle is at least 50 pages. I open the first one and begin reading. And then I open the second and the third. My phone keeps ringing, but I put it on flight mode and ignore it. I forget to have lunch. I forget the story I'm supposed to be writing that day. For hours and hours, I forget everything but Nellie. Because this is it. This is what we've been waiting for. These documents tell the story not only of Nellie's life after she left Porirua and of her death, but they also have the answers to some of the other questions we've been struggling with for months. It's late afternoon by the time I finish reading, meaning it's the middle of the night in the UK, but I messaged Sarah anyway. I write, "Holy shit." Hours later, she replies, "I know." The files are a mess of letters and hospital notes and various forms. It seems like the coroner must have asked for Nellie's files from the rest home where she died, and from her file from her doctor, and for her psychiatrist notes. There's also witness evidence from the coronial hearing, but it's all completely out of order. Some of the pages are handwritten, some are typed, and some pages just end abruptly in the middle of a sentence. The next page might be included in a different bundle, or in some cases, I can't find the end of the notes at all. The earliest document I find is an intake form from the psychiatric unit at Wellington Hospital. Remember, these are all documents about the end of Nellie's life. We still don't actually have anything from Porirua itself. The intake form was written in 2002 when Nellie was 61. It says Nellie was admitted after staff at Glenbrook Lodge, the rest home where she lived after leaving Porirua, could no longer cope with her psychotic episodes and, quote, challenging behaviour. Dr. Delprasanne da Silva, the psychiatric registrar to the mental health crisis team, also wrote two letters to Nellie's GP while she was in hospital. He explained that Nellie was admitted in hope of stabilising her medication and, quote, reassessing her placement.
Nellie has a diagnosis of chronic paranoid schizophrenia and has had extended admissions to Porirua Hospital.
So this confirms it. Nellie did have a schizophrenia diagnosis.
This is compounded by mild to moderate intellectual impairment. She was discharged from Villa 3, Porirua Hospital, to Glenbrook Lodge in 1994.
The notes say Nellie coped fairly well with this transition. But in 2001, she was taken off her long-time medication, an antipsychotic called thioridazine, which works to calm the brain. After this, everything went downhill. Nellie was tried on a combination of other antipsychotics and sedatives, but none of them seemed to work. Nellie's psychosis and her hallucinations worsened. Her behaviour deteriorated. Dr. De Silva said she was constantly in conflict with staff and other patients.
This is usually initiated by Nellie accusing other residents of calling her names or trying to physically harm her. She accuses other residents of inappropriate sexual behaviour. She often becomes agitated when firm limits are placed and often harms herself by striking herself in the face.
Nellie was clearly not in a good mental state at this point. Dr. De Silva's letter cites an incident where Nellie actually threatened to kill a neighbourhood child because she believed this kid had been calling her names. Her physical health was also clearly suffering. She weighed just 48 kilograms on admission to the hospital. She wasn't sleeping, and she had bruises on her face from hitting herself. You might be wondering, if taking Nellie off her medication caused so many problems, why would the doctors do it? But actually, it wasn't their choice. Thioridazine was effectively banned worldwide in the early 2000s because it sometimes caused a serious side effect called cardiac arrhythmia, an irregular heartbeat, and this could cause sudden death. The problem was that many stable patients suddenly deteriorated after being taken off this drug. In fact, one study showed that after the formal withdrawal of thioridazine in 2005, the hospitalisation rate of schizophrenia patients doubled. Ideally, in Nellie's case, she would be allowed back on the drug with special permission, Dr. De Silva wrote, but she would need a cardiology review first, which he described as an extensive process that couldn't happen right away, and Glenbrook Lodge wasn't prepared to wait.
I've discussed at length with the staff at Glenbrook, and they feel that they have tried all the behavioural interventions in their power with Nellie and have been unsuccessful. They feel unable to provide care for Nellie and request review of her placement.
Okay, I'll just shift your frame out of the way.
Nellie was transferred to a specialist psychogeriatric hospital called Elizabeth Memorial in Burrampour, a suburb in southern Wellington. It was 30 k's away from Mavis, at least an hour train ride, and the farthest Nellie had been from Porirua in 40 years.
How's your tummy feeling at the moment?
At intake, staff did a full assessment of Nellie's needs. You remember we talked about this form last episode. It's the one that had a bunch of strange information about Nellie's former occupation and her hobbies, like where it listed running. But that was just one of dozens and dozens of pages from Elizabeth Memorial's intake form. They go through her goals and her care needs and what activities she wanted to join in on, which, according to the answers Nellie gave, was almost everything, from dancing to puzzles to watching movies.
It doesn't have to be a cesarean.
Anything is too dangerous.
Not if you know what you're doing.
She particularly liked Shortland Street.
You're not in Guatemala now, Dr. Ropita.
After reading this, it kind of seems like this slightly bizarre and incorrect information on the form might actually have come from Nellie herself, rather than from a social worker, as we earlier assumed. While Nellie seemed to settle into Elizabeth well enough, the documents show that for the rest of 2002, and to be honest, for the rest of Nellie's life, doctors really struggled to get Nellie's medication under control. She'd been released from Wellington Hospital on a long list of different drugs, including a huge dose of something called chlorpromazine, which was another first-generation antipsychotic. The psychiatrists treating Nellie were clearly unhappy about this, seemingly because chlorpromazine could cause dizziness and therefore cause people to fall and hurt themselves.
I was a little surprised to learn that my house surgeon discharged Nellie still on a witch's brew of not only olanzapine, but also chlorpromazine and zopiclone.
So that's two antipsychotics and a sedative.
I would certainly support you reducing the chlorpromazine, and indeed I would stop it very rapidly.
This was from Dr. John Grigger, another psychiatrist, in March 2002. In April, Nellie had her first appointment with her next psychiatrist, Sally Davidson, who would go on to treat her for the next 6 years. Dr. Davidson initially wrote to Nellie's GP saying she agreed with Dr. Grigger, but just a few months later, she wrote again saying her attempts to reduce Nellie's medication had been, quote, disastrous.
There was a recurrence of increased anxiety, head banging and assault with increased irritability and demanding behaviour. In early May, the chlorpromazine was reinstituted.
Sally Davidson was brought on to Nellie's clinical team after she was moved from Glenbrook, part of a bunch of changes for Nellie that made her care arrangements much more formal. While Nellie was at Wellington Hospital, the doctors and social workers actually arranged for her to be assessed.
maybe for the first time, for her eligibility as a compulsory patient under the Mental Health Act. They also got Nellie registered with the Public Trust so they could manage her money, and they had Mavis made her legal guardian. Dr. Davidson's description of this last part of the process was particularly eye-opening in terms of what Nellie might have been through at Porirua Hospital.
We attempted to talk to Nellie about making an application for a welfare guardian, and Nellie initially misunderstood and believed we were giving someone else the right to give her shock treatment. Nellie's initial response was one of terror and anxiety.
Sally Davidson later said they managed to pacify Nellie, but they didn't really think she understood the guardianship process at all, which included a court hearing and a whole lot of documentation, including Dr. Davidson's assessments of her mental health.
Nellie's prognosis in terms of her continued mental disorder is not very good, and she's now of an age where physical ailments and gradually increasing cognitive impairment will increase her dependence on and need for 24-hour care.
In March 2003, Nellie was made an indefinite patient subject to a compulsory treatment order. That meant, on one hand, Nellie had to stay at Elizabeth Memorial. She wasn't a voluntary patient anymore. But also, it meant that, by law, every few months, Dr. Davidson had to meet with Nellie and report back to her GP and the district mental health inspector. The level of detail in Dr. Davidson's reports makes them kind of incredible. They give us not only Nellie's history and confirmation of her diagnosis.
Nellie is a beneficiary with a very long history of treatment-resistant schizophrenia complicated by mild intellectual handicap.
They track her ongoing mental health issues.
Increased agitation and self-harming behaviours lately, including punching herself and scratching her legs badly.
And her physical health.
Nellie is still remarkably agile with respect to mobility up and down stairs without requiring support from the handrail.
And the reality of her daily life.
Staff confirm Nellie's ongoing poor stress tolerance, whilst at times she is genuinely deluded with self-referential persecution. They have also observed Nellie advising other residents to threaten to hit themselves to get what they want, indicating Nellie's institutional behaviour persists.
Some of Sally Davidson's reports are terribly sad. I find the lines about the institutionalisation and Nellie's experience of persecution in particular really hard going. And sometimes Dr. Davidson will refer to things like Nellie's complaints that residents or staff were picking on her or sexually assaulting her as delusions. And it kind of makes me wonder, like, were they delusions? Were they always imagined? Or was she actually being maltreated? And because she was schizophrenic, she wasn't believed. But Dr. Davidson also has this way of describing Nellie that makes me smile over and over again.
Nellie believed other residents in the nursing home were very jealous of her because she was a Gemini. She enjoys her food, although she commented that it seemed a dirty trick that the ice cream for dessert had often melted by the time she got to it.
And this one, which I think is my favourite, from May 2005.
At review today, Nellie was stylishly attired in her green coat, which she thought made her look like Greta Garbo, greeting me happily with a kiss on both cheeks. She was very mobile physically and very at ease in my office, where she sat perched on the chair with her legs crossed, regaling both Helen and I with stories. She had thoroughly enjoyed a visit from her sister and nephew yesterday and laughed with childlike glee when recounting how the Pepsi they had brought for her had fizzed over when the bottle was opened, spraying one of her relations.
I got the feeling Dr. Davidson was fond of Nellie, and she wasn't the only one. Another psychiatrist, who was brought in to assess whether Nellie had dementia in 2006, wrote that Nellie could be very charming.
Nellie was reported to remember all the staff names. She recognised everyone, never got lost in the rest home, and sharply followed the clock. Nellie was a rather cute and mischievous individual. In fact, her very behaviours endeared her to staff that took great pride in caring for her and didn't want Nellie to be taken off them.
In fact, the notes show that at points, Nellie's team of clinicians really went into bat for her. In late 2002, so about 6 months after she was admitted to Elizabeth Memorial, It was discovered that Nellie had a severe uterine prolapse, which had been left untreated for years. Her GP, Tom Farrer, referred her to the gynaecology unit at Wellington Hospital for surgery. The hospital declined the request twice, saying they, quote, didn't think she was a good surgical candidate, and saying that Nellie didn't want the surgery anyway because the protruding lump, quote, wasn't troubling her. Dr. Farrer wrote an absolutely scathing letter back.
Although, as you say, Nellie claims that the prolapse is not troubling her, this is not correct because her mental state from her chronic schizophrenia, institutionalisation and intellectual impairment is totally unreliable, and she really does not know what is going on in the world apart from wanting cigarettes and coke. She is totally incontinent, and her sister, nursing staff and I all feel that it's in Nellie's best interest to get this prolapse fixed.
Nellie finally had the surgery in 2004, 2 years after that initial diagnosis, and she recovered quickly. But at the same time, the documents show that generally, Nellie's health was in decline. In the space of just a few years, she'd had a fall and broken her wrist. She'd had the skin graft on her leg, which had failed and had to be repeated. And her mental state was getting more and more confused. As early as 2004, Dr. Davidson was wondering if Nellie was suffering dementia.
She can no longer recall the year of her birth, and for the first time when I saw her recently, struggled to recall her star sign.
The consultant psychiatrist said no. He was convinced it wasn't dementia. Dr. Davidson referred Nellie again in 2006, but again, the expert geriatric psychiatrist just wasn't convinced. By 2007, Sally Davidson was reporting that Nellie was more withdrawn than usual. At one review, she said Nellie smelled of urine and that she was anxious and she started headbanging in the clinic. At her next appointment, Nellie was calmer, but her memory had declined even further. She couldn't give her age, or the month when Christmas was celebrated, or the order of the seasons. Dr. Davidson wondered if Nellie was on too much medication, if she was being sedated, and believed it might have been due to her intake of diazepam, an anti-anxiety drug also marketed as Valium.
I would certainly be inclined to try to keep her diazepam at a minimum, given the risk for sedation, falls, and perhaps increased incontinence at night.
The next significant entry on the file doesn't come until mid-2008, in July. Nellie has pneumonia. She's going downhill rapidly. Her new GP, Dr. Richard Medlicott, prescribes antibiotics. By August, she's improved and up to her old tricks. There are numerous incident reports about her demanding cigarettes and, quote, playing up when she can't have them. But in late September, Nellie gets pneumonia again. Dr. Medlicott writes a note to himself and the staff saying, remember, last time this escalated really quickly. He puts Nellie on intravenous antibiotics and once again she begins to improve.
What do you need now? Oh no. Help! We need some help in here for Nellie!
On September 24, there is a new flurry of incident reports in the file.
Right after staff handover, Maria heard Nellie calling out Lawrence's name.
These are witness statements from staff. They're all handwritten.
We heard Maria, one of the nurse aides, screaming my name and Maisie and Nellie's name. We immediately run to her side.
Found her in a pool of blood on the floor with her face and left arm across her chest.
Blood all over her face.
In the middle of care, she asked for a smoke. We took her to the smoking area by wheelchair.
Placed her in a lazy boy chair, ice pack placed on top of her nose to stop bleeding.
She remained in the chair for the day and also to see Dr. Medlicott.
Further action, do reports. Recommended memo to have a proper handover cited of all patients.
Dr. Medlicott's notes from that day are brief. He says Nellie had a swollen nose and it might have deviated a bit to the left, that it was likely a fracture. Nellie probably fell out of bed, he says, but he's happy to leave her at the rest home because otherwise it would interrupt the care for her pneumonia, which is improving. On the morning of Saturday, 27 September, Dr. Medlicott gets a call from the rest home. Nellie is struggling to breathe and she's drowsy. He tells nursing staff to resume both intramuscular and oral antibiotics. That night, when Dr. Medlicott checks in, staff report that Nellie's comfortable. But by Sunday morning, things are again not good.
It was clear that she had deteriorated rapidly, with blood pressure now 80 over 50 and had become cyanotic.
In other words, Nellie's skin is turning blue. Dr. Medlicott arranges for an ambulance to take Nellie to Wellington Hospital. By the time they arrive, Nellie is unconscious and non-responsive. The staff at Wellington Hospital's emergency department see Nellie's black eyes, note that she'd fallen, and immediately assume she's suffering a brain hemorrhage that's bleeding inside her skull, a potentially life-threatening injury. They order a CAT scan and talk to neurology, but the results are inconclusive and kind of confusing. There's no hemorrhage, but there's possibly some other brain bruising, but it might just be a shadow on the scan. They're not really sure. The doctors talk to Mavis, who arrives as soon as she can, and together they decide to remove Nellie's breathing tube and let nature take its course. Nellie Wilson dies at 2:37 p.m., just 40 minutes after her family arrived at the hospital. When we talk to Mavis, she only remembers this as a time of complete confusion.
It seemed like a storage room. No, we weren't even in a
proper room.
That's what it seemed like. And I can't remember if the police came first or the minister. I think the minister came first and he gave her her last rites. So I don't know what you call it, but he said things that we all, we said the Lord's Prayer too. And then the police came. A few police, I think, and they said to me, when did you last see Nellie? I can't remember what I said, you know.
In March 2009, so almost 6 months later, the coroner, Judge Gary Evans, sent Mavis and her siblings a letter. It was titled, "Your Late Sister," and explained that Judge Evans had a report from pathologist Dr. John Rutherford. Dr. Rutherford said the cause of Nellie's death was acute left ventricular failure secondary to hypertensive heart disease, basically heart failure. She also had several other long-standing issues, likely from smoking or the medication she was on.
Dr. Rutherford says the main pathological findings were pulmonary edema, congestion of the liver, enlargement of the heart, and long-standing disease of the right kidney. There was no evidence that the head injury that Miss Wilson had sustained a few days before her death had resulted in any sinister intracranial pathology. Miss Wilson suffered a nasal fracture.
The coroner says he also has a report from Dr. Medlicott and his clinical notes. That report showed that Nellie received good care at his hands.
Ordinarily, there would be no need for me to sit at inquest into Miss Wilson's death.
But because Nellie was a compulsory mental health patient, legally the coroner had to do a full investigation and the family were invited to participate in an inquest.
So in the court, what did they just ask the doctor some questions or?
Yeah, I think, I can't remember.
You wish you got up and said something.
I wished I got up and said, but I don't know, you're in shock or you just don't know and understand, you're just in a different space. But today I would say, well, you know, what did they find out? If she had all these bruising on her and that.
And fractures.
And I'm sure I remember, we didn't know what medication she was on. I'm sure those words were said. And I said, how could that be? But then maybe I got mixed up. Maybe it's, I don't know.
Mavis hadn't got mixed up. The final document in the bundle is the full autopsy report. You might remember, this is the document that Sarah first read all those years ago when she met Mavis and the whole family that first time, just after Mavis's husband's funeral when everyone was smoking and Sarah got completely overwhelmed. This is the document that largely started Sarah and then me, now all of you, on this journey in the first place. It's the one which made Sarah and Mavis and all the family think that Nellie might have been murdered or severely neglected. When I read this report, I can see why it immediately sparks suspicion in Sarah's brain. There is something cold, kind of brutal about it. The correct word is probably clinical, but I don't know. It's just, there's just something in the way that it's written, particularly if you hadn't heard everything we've just heard from that coronial file, that just sends shivers up the spine.
The body was identified from a name band around the right ankle. The body was wrapped in two white sheets. Rigor mortis was present.
The report runs through a bit of what we know already. Nellie's time of death, and that she was suffering pneumonia. It says her health generally had deteriorated over the last 6 to 12 months due to age catching up with her. It summarises her medical history, including a single mention of schizophrenia at the bottom of one page, which Sarah must have missed the first time, and it gives a summary of the hospital records. Under medication, it says, her medication was not recorded. There's also a heading that says, recent injuries. The language is heavily medical. It lists 6 points, including bilateral periorbital hematomas, abrasions on both knees, and fingertip-type bruises on both arms. But, and this is critical, it didn't explain how those injuries were caused, like that it was a fall out of bed. It just notes them and moves on in a way that you can't help but find suspicious. The report also noted that Nellie had various older injuries, including bruises on her lower limbs.
It is known that antipsychotic medication may predispose to heart failure. It is not clear if she was on such medication, and if so, what role it might have played.
On first reading, this last statement by the pathologist struck me in the same way it must have struck Sarah and Mavis. How did they not know what medication Nellie was on? But the thing is, Nellie's medical team did know, and her dosage and its effect on her was being closely monitored, including with regular cardiology appointments. It was just that the information wasn't available to the pathologist at the time of the autopsy. I find this whole thing really frustrating. You hear this quite a bit about the coronial process, that normal people go in and they don't really have any idea about what's happening. There's no one interpreting for them or holding their hand through it, and it is a big process. And the way this whole thing was handled just seems so unfair and unnecessary. Mavis and then Sarah have spent years pondering these questions and feeling this sense of guilt that they didn't really need to be feeling. I'm about to call Sarah and talk to her about all of this, but before I do, I just want to mention one more thing that was on the file. Just a couple of lines that were buried deep in a report from Dr. Nisa Contractor, the geriatric psychiatrist who assessed Nellie twice for dementia. He, unlike us, had full access to all of Nellie's psychiatric notes from her time at Porirua. He says there were 4 volumes and, bless him, he'd read through all of them before writing his first report in 2004. Dr. Contractor's summary of these notes finally gives us the answers to some of our other long-standing questions about Nellie's intellectual impairment and about her admission to Porirua.
Nellie had undergone formal psychological assessment for her IQ in 1952 when Nellie was 12 years old, and that had placed her full IQ scale at 58 to 68, with a reading age of 9 years and 8 months.
Dr. Contractor said that categorised Nellie as having low IQ.
She presented to the psychiatric services by her parents, via her then GP, in 1960 when Nellie was 20 years old. She was described as a thin young woman with no spontaneity, lack of interest in her surroundings, paucity of speech and thought, grimacing, rocking her head back and forth and unable to answer any questions put to her. She was observed hallucinating, with brief periods of, quote, foolish laughter.
Dr. Contractor also explained that period that Nellie lived with her mother in the 1970s, saying that although she suffered the consequences of what he called prolonged institutionalisation, there were attempts to let her have periods living outside the hospital, what they called social admissions, but at the time he was writing, in 2004, this was no longer possible.
She is someone who will never be able to survive without the type of support and accommodation she is in now.
I ring Sarah. It's a tough phone call. We've learned so much about Nellie from these documents, and I think it's going to take a while to all sink in.
I mean, her life was like pretty horrific, really. Because obviously then she just had a complete schizophrenic mental breakdown and then ended up in Porirua, and then she lived there for the rest of her life, where she was abused and given shock treatment. And, you know, then she used to exchange her body for, like, cigarettes and stuff, and they had to, like, control that. And, yeah, all her life, institutionalised. So it must have been pretty bad in there.
There are a couple of things that Sarah still has questions about, even after reading the full file. The main one is about the incident at the rest home where Nellie broke her nose.
That was the most interesting one because they got statements, witness statements from all the people that were working. So you've got, in their own words, what happened. The nurse who'd been on duty previously was a guy, and she kept saying his name. Like, why? Why was she doing that? You know, how did that happen? How did she fall, supposedly? And then why was she just repeating his name over and over and screaming? Was it because she liked him and she wanted him for comfort? Or was it because he did something to her and she was trying to tell someone? I don't know.
Sarah thinks we should try and find someone who was there to talk to about this fall and about Nellie's treatment while she was at Elizabeth Memorial.
Like, you can look through the notes, obviously. You can see the names of all the nurses and everything. They should be easy to track because there's so many and it says all their names and everything.
The problem is, the people described as nurses in this file, they're largely not registered nurses. They're care workers and they didn't use their last names on the statements. Also, Elizabeth Memorial shut down in 2014. It was owned by a large multinational and there's no one around now who can speak on its behalf. Initially, I'd been hoping that the psychiatrist, Dr. Sally Davidson, might talk to me, but she declined a request for an interview.
Hi, Richard.
Oh, hi, Richard. It's Kirsty Johnston.
But there is one other person involved in Nellie's care who is still around and still working in Wellington.
So you're working on an interesting project, you said.
I am. I thought that might pique your interest. You might not,
yeah, sure.
You might not say no straight away.
Dr. Richard Medlicott was Nellie's GP. He's the one who treated her for pneumonia just before she died and who saw her fractured nose. I'm hoping he'll remember Nellie.
Look, the name totally rings a bell.
I can describe her for you if you want and it might help with it.
Yeah, sure.
So she had chronic schizophrenia and she's a bit of a character, I think. She was heavily nicotine addicted.
Yep.
I think a lot of her time revolved around, like, how she was going to get...
I tell Richard a little bit more about Nellie, and suddenly it clicks for him.
Yes, that's all coming back, yep.
Yeah.
I do remember Nellie well. Quite a little woman. She had a bird-like face, And she would pester you for cigarettes. That was her. She would just want a cigarette, and I'd defer off to the
Dr. Medlicott told me he worked with the patients at Elizabeth Memorial from about 1998 until it closed. He'd go up there about once a week. Nellie wasn't the only former Porirua patient at Elizabeth, he said, or the only one with significant mental health issues.
Schizophrenia is a really debilitating disease. I think schizophrenia would be, most people would agree, it's the most significant and debilitating of the mental health conditions. People with schizophrenia and so on tend to age much faster and need higher levels of care, and many of those would then shift from support in the community to, you know, some of them end up in psychogeriatric hospitals like Elizabeth Memorial.
I asked Dr. Medlicott why people with schizophrenia aged faster and why they died earlier.
It's associated with so many other things. There's higher rates of smoking, there's higher rates of loneliness, there's higher rates of dental disease, and of course medications themselves can lead on to complications, including diabetes and Parkinsonianism and so on and so forth. So, schizophrenia is not a good illness to get.
Yeah, and you mentioned that, I don't know how much you remember about her specifically, but like patients had, they were institutionalised.
Yeah, look, it's not a specific diagnosis, but in the bad old days, I mean, people were often kind of admitted to these long-term mental health hospitals for fairly innocuous stuff. And so people would go in and be surrounded by people who would have some severely abnormal behaviours, and they would learn abnormal behaviours. So that's the issue with institutionalisation, is it's not just the illness, it's that you're surrounded by, instead of being surrounded by young adults or children whose behaviour we would class as more normal, to put that in parenthesis, you know, you're surrounded by people who are doing odd behaviours.
Yeah, I could see in the notes that, like, Nellie learned that if she, like, self-harmed, like, bang her head on something or, you know, that the staff would give her a cigarette.
Yeah, I remember that now.
Dr. Medlicott said the whole process of deinstitutionalisation was huge. It called for, like, basically re-socialising all these people who didn't know anything about, like, money or public transport or anything normal, really.
Now, one of these guys had just been a bit slow when he was 8 and he ended up at Cherry Farm and came out when he was 65.
Cherry Farm was another institution in the South Island.
And so how do you kind of take those people and reintroduce them into going to the shops and kind of what we think of as normal life? And you know, it happened, and thank goodness it happened. But it was a challenge, and hopefully we won't have to do it again, you know, because we won't have people living this way.
While we're talking, Dr. Medlicott is scanning through Nellie's notes, trying to refresh his mind. I ask him if he thinks Nellie's death was premature.
Yeah, I mean, how old was she when she died? She was 68 by the looks of things. So, yeah, that's pretty young for you and me. But for a lifelong smoker and someone with schizophrenia and the medications that you've been on, then it's about par for the course. I remember her broken nose. That was towards the end. She'd fallen over and still see it in my mind's eye, but I guess these things happen as you're getting old and frail, unfortunately.
Did she get good care at Elizabeth Memorial? Or?
I think she did. The staff were very caring. They would try and look after a complex bunch of people with complex behaviours in a facility that was starting to get old and a bit tired. I think she got good care.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, hey, thank you so much for telling me what you remembered of Nellie.
She's worth remembering.
I think we've arrived at a point where we can safely say that Nellie's death wasn't suspicious. To me, and the multiple other doctors we asked to look at the autopsy report, her injuries, like the broken nose and the scraped knees, can be explained by a fall. And then the fingertip-type bruises were likely made by staff lifting her to get her back up. But weirdly,
even though her death might not be criminal, this somehow doesn't make it feel any better. Despite Dr. Medlicott's belief that Nellie got good care, the dozens of incident reports on her file show that Nellie was also regularly restrained with drugs or by physical force, and that her life at Elizabeth Memorial was small, it was limited, and often extremely stressful. When I talk to Sarah, I can tell she's also finding all of this hard to come to terms with and wondering really what it all means.
Yeah, like what it says about women or adoption or
all of
mental health.
I feel like we are almost at the end of Nellie's story now. But just as I'm about to tell Sarah this, she jumps in.
Oh, and the other thing was, they mentioned twice about another child. One time in the medical file, and then another time, I think it was the corona file, where they mentioned another daughter.
I don't know how I didn't notice this, or maybe I did and I just didn't register it, but then again, there were almost 1,000 pages in those bundles.
I can't remember. It was something like she's had two children, both girls or something, or like she has two daughters or something like that. I think we should try and find out where she went when she was 14, because that's what I'd like to find. I'd like to find a sister.
That's next time on Nellie's Baby. Thanks for listening to Nellie's Baby. If you liked this program, make sure to follow or subscribe using your favourite podcast app or listen ad-free at rnz.co.nz. While you're there, you can browse RNZ's excellent range of podcasts like Dear Wars, Conviction and The Detail, our daily news podcast. You can also find a whole lot of Nellie's Baby's extras, including feature articles, photographs and bonus podcasts at our show page, rnz.co.nz/Nellie's Baby, and that's Nellie spelled N-E-L-L-I-E.
Nellie's Baby is presented by Kirsty Johnston. The executive producer is Tim Watkin and the executive editor is John Hartevelt. The producers are William Ray and Justin Gregory. The sound engineers are Phil Benge, William Saunders and Mark Chesterman. The production coordinator is Brianna Juritich. Special thanks to Dr. Hilary Stace and Dr. Olive Webb for their help in producing this podcast, and extra special thanks to Sarah.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.